Welcome to The Sustainable Life. This is Josh Spodek, and I'm here with Madeline Ostrander. Madeline, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. And I've been looking forward to this for a couple of reasons. I mean, we've been talking offline. And one, I want to hear how your commitment went. And also, we've been talking a bit about the interplay between individual action, collective change, and some of the stories and the individual people and in communities in your book. I propose we start with the commitment. Are you game?
Sure.
So last time I asked you what the environment meant to you and led you through a series of questions into something you might be able to do to manifest the emotions of that experience. Do you remember what you talked about and what you committed to?
Yeah, so I was going to try to do more errands, of which I have many to do these days, on a bicycle. So that was my commitment.
Do you remember where it came from? What was the your experience of nature before that led to it?
Yeah, so we talked about a time when I was a child and I had there was this beautiful silver maple tree in my backyard, and I used to climb it and sit there for a long period of time with my journal and look out on the world. And it was kind of a refuge for me. And although sitting in a tree and riding on a bicycle are fairly different, I think there's something about, I think the tree both represents my connection to nature, but I also think it represents just a more general sense of connectedness to the world. And I think that a lot of the technologies and ways of living that we have now disconnect us from the world and from each other. And so I think riding a bicycle is somehow very immersive. It connects you to what you're doing and gives you a sense of awareness.
Yeah, I'm glad that I asked about the silver maple, because even though biking and climbing trees might look very different, that emotion is, to me, the key starting point, this intrinsic emotion that everyone has. I mean, for you, it was a tree. For me, my sledding hill and lots of other things. And, you know, I really want to get people, I want to help people get to where they see that nature is not something that's over there or back then. And that connection is more intrinsic. It might not look the same from the outside, but anyway, I wanted to reinforce that and make sure listeners, we've access to these things all the time.
Yeah.
So sorry for my digression there for a second.
No.
To the listeners. So how did it go? How did biking go with all the errands? I have too many also.
So admittedly, it was a little mixed, and I ran across a couple of obstacles. And I also did one thing that I didn't talk about on the podcast. So the mixed part is just that I realized that certain things, like I needed to go pick up some cans of paint, and those are big and heavy, and I do not have a bike trailer or anything about my bike that's really set up in terms of capacity to carry something as significant as some paint cans. So I mean, I think that was actually instructive, because it led me to some thoughts about, well, how would I change, you know, what I have available to me, either by, you know, getting myself a bike trailer or maybe sharing these errands with other people. And admittedly, I have a ways to go before figuring that out. But I think that to some degree, that's part of the value of trying something like this, is that it forces you to rethink things a little bit. I also thought about how I have this, I used to live in a co-housing community, so which is like a kind of like a set of townhouses, but where there's an intentional community involved. And there's a lot of sharing of errands and sharing of picking things up. And that I thought that was both really lovely and also a thing that, you know, a solution that isn't talked about enough, about how we share things in a community. And the other thing that I did was I had to make a trip to Portland, and I decided to take Amtrak instead of taking my car. And, you know, I would have thought about that probably anyway, but I think that the fact that we talked about transportation made me feel even more strongly like, well, I should take the train. And again, like being on the train and climbing a tree are very different things, but there is something about train travel that, again, situates you in the world and makes you aware of your fellow passengers and makes you slow down and like see the environment around you and take in your region. And You know, we rode along the Columbia River and through a lot of forest, and it's a different experience than if you're stuck on an interstate. So I enjoyed that a lot.
Well, I'm honored if our conversation helped lead to that switch in modes, and that switch in modes was joyful. I know that a lot of people feel like, oh, Amtrak, train, I could drive. Driving is freedom, and a train is trapped. And your experience, if I heard you right, says otherwise.
In general, the people who are on the Amtrak train are pretty happy. Unless, of course, you know, something breaks down, which is true of your car as well, right? But when you're on the road and people are behind the wheel, there's so much road rage, there's so much impatience, there's so much unhappiness on the highway, honestly. And I mean, I feel it myself. It's stressful driving. But when you're on the train, everyone's relaxed. They're hanging out in the dining car, getting themselves a cider or whatever, looking out the window. And they talk to each other in a much different way than you would in a lot of other modes of transportation. There's conversations that start up among strangers. So, yeah, I mean, I think riding Amtrak is a joyful experience.
And you also mentioned that when you said the paint cans, what I expected was what a lot of people would say was, I just can't carry that. But you went right to a bike trailer, which is not, I think, a standard thought for most people. I mean, if you're in Holland, sure. But I think in America, maybe out there are more people with bike trailers. Actually, here there's a lot, but it's almost always delivery people and not the average person. But when you said that, I thought she didn't just say, I'm going to do what I said, and that's it. Like, I'm going to set a target, and if I get 80% of that, that's a B, and 90%, oh, that's an A. But you went in a direction and felt, I hear, intrinsic motivation to keep going more.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it would be fun and rewarding and nice to be able to do more of my errands and business on my bicycle. I mentioned this, but I'm relocating soon across the country to the Boston area. And there's a ton of bike infrastructure there and also a lot of transit infrastructure. So it could be very easy if I could figure out how to set myself up to do almost everything on a bicycle. So, I mean, I look forward to that.
This is funny because in Eastern Oregon is one of the people in my spring workshop, and she has started biking with a trailer and taking her kids around. And apparently she lives on a hill, and she's like, oh, it was a really big pain. That was months ago. And now she's like, that's a big pain, but it's just what I do. It's sort of people who know and habit, the patterns with habits is at first it takes effort. The eventual goal is when it becomes part of your identity and you just do it without thinking about it.
Yeah.
And another woman who's in the workshop she was in New York, graduated from Columbia, and now lives in Boston. And she's also started biking around. And when she first started, I think if I remember right, the chain was all rusty, it needed a lot of work, and she took it outside. And she was talking like you at first it's talking like I expected you, but when you said the trailer, it wasn't like you. But she was like, oh, I don't know if this is going to work or not. And her first stage was just take it off and take it out and make it less clear off some of the gunk. As it happened, her neighbor went by and said, oh, I have a bike stand. That'll make that a lot easier. And one thing led to another. And like now biking is like she's in a community of people that support the biking that only happened because she took the first step. And the first step, she didn't expect to go anywhere.
Yeah. So I guess one thing I should say is that biking is part of my family culture to a large extent. And what I mean by that is, for instance, mainly my husband's family. So when my husband was 18, he and his brother and his dad did a bike trip across the entire United States from Arlington, Virginia to Seattle.
Oh, backward. Upwind.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I think for him, cycling has always been associated since he was a teenager with a sense of freedom. So for some people, driving is associated with a sense of freedom, but I think for him, cycling has always been associated with a sense of freedom. And he and I have done a lot of, or a fair number of long distance bike trips. We did one last summer where we rode 500 miles through BC and Idaho and the northeast corner of Washington State. And those kinds of rides are also really joyful and they're hard. But I see what a bicycle can do. And it's incredibly powerful to realize that you can do this thing with this very simple technology and your body and all on your own power, go all of these miles and all of this distance. It's really amazing. So I already have that as part of my background. So it's not as big of a leap for me to think about a bike trailer.
And yeah, it's this cool piece of technology. And it turns out you don't have to dig cobalt in Africa, and you don't have to get lithium out of, well, that's a whole other topic. But bicycles are so, yeah, the summer between high school and college, I rode my bike from Philadelphia to Maine and back with a friend. And it also, and you know, we put everything on the bikes and just tented, slept in tents and things like that. And yeah, it was really a transformative, I don't know if it was transformative, but it was definitely formative. It gave me a sense of freedom that I can go anywhere on my own, and I can. Oh my God. And now I have to remember a past guest. I don't know if you know, Spartan Race, the obstacle course company, but yeah. The founder and head guy, Joe DeSena, who's done he's done tons of, Ironmans and like really long endurance competitions, and he really loves them. And then he started Spartan Race to make obstacle courses for people. He once invited me up to his farm, and I got a ride up there with someone who was going up in Vermont. And I talked about, I haven't yet done it, but I do intend to bike up there sometime. And he gives me directions there. He goes, yeah, it's easy. Just take Route 9 north from the city, make a right at this bridge, and there you are. I'm like, you just went from New York City to Vermont with one turn? Like, that's his way of figuring things out. And I actually, it is, once I looked at it, it was like, it kind of made sense. And I wrote him back and said, well, when you did that, did you bring a tent? Did you sleep at friends' houses? Did you stay in hotels? And he writes back one word email. Sleep? I'm like, oh my God, this guy's on a whole other level than me. So I'm not going to go in one shot. But anyway, so sorry, I couldn't help but reminisce or perhaps share in the joy that I felt from you about biking.
This actually connects well to another part of the conversation that I think we were going to have about Richmond, California, because cycling has also been a big part of their journey.
Let's dive into that.
Yeah. So in my book, there's a couple of people that I profile in Richmond, California, and one is Dory Robinson, who leads this urban farming organization in Richmond. Mm-hmm. And her partner, whose name is Najari, runs a cycling organization. And both of them, when I interviewed Najari at his bike shop, he told me that his organization, which is called Rich City Rides, is essentially using bicycles as a sort of subversive way to get people to feel empowered and feel like they can be healthy and feel like they can change their city. And so the simple act of cycling gives people a sense of personal power. And especially in a community like Richmond, where you know people often have a lot of economic constraints. Richmond has a lot of, you know, a higher than average level of poverty. Richmond has a lot of people who have very modest incomes. And so not everybody can even afford a car. So having access to bike, having bike trails, which is something that Najari and Doria have both campaigned for really heavily over many years, is really important. And Rich City Rides has also trained people, you know, people who haven't had a lot of other opportunities, people who, don't have a lot of, other kinds of ways to find employment. He's helped train young people in how to fix bikes and how to run a bike shop. And so there's a whole cohort of people who've come up through Rich City Rides who've developed this sense of empowerment on so many different levels through bicycles. It's really excellent.
I have to comment. You said it can give them, I think you said economic power, but also gives them literal power. I mean, it develops muscles. It strengthens you and you become more powerful. It also, just to remind everyone, Chevron is there and it doesn't fund Chevron. I mean, Chevron must hate bicycles. It's like the opposite of their business.
Yeah, one of their main supporters who was on the city council for many, many years. His name is Nat Bates. He's been a mayor, and I you know don't want to be disrespectful of this person because he also was an important leader in the community, and you know was one of the first African American political leaders in the region and one of the longest standing political leaders. But he was very opposed to the idea of bike infrastructure and just felt like, why would people want a bike? And I found it puzzling because there are a lot of bikes in Richmond and there are a lot of people who depended on that, again, because they couldn't necessarily afford cars. I guess to back up, maybe I could give a little background about Richmond, which is that it's a city at the north end of the San Francisco Bay and just above Berkeley. And it's an old industrial city, so we really... The refinery is 120 years old, and it actually is older than the city itself, so it existed there first. But the city grew up especially around the wartime industry during the 40s, when there was a lot of shipbuilding and there was a lot of manufacturing to support World War II. And a lot of people came to the area for jobs, including a lot of Black Americans came to Richmond to look for jobs. They came up from the South. It was part of the Great Migration. And there were opportunities there, but there was also discrimination. And there was a lot of housing discrimination. And what that the pattern that that created in the city is that a lot of the people of color have lived in housing that's closer to the refinery and more in the path of pollution. And you know, then there's been a lot of, there's been economic decline over the years. So the Richmond, Chevron has remained the main economic force in the city, and still a lot of the city's revenue is reliant on Chevron. So the community has been in a kind of quandary because they're both dependent on this industry, and also that industry is creating a lot of pollution. There's higher than average rates of asthma. There's other health problems that are associated with the refinery, like some risks of cancer. And so it's been really complicated for the community living there. And there's been a sense of disempowerment and a sense that people didn't have a lot of opportunities. In the 80s, the crack cocaine epidemic hit the city really hard, and a lot of people were struggling with addiction. There was some gang violence that came out of that. And so Doria, especially, she's a third generation Richmond resident. She grew up in the middle of all of that. And I think for a long time, she felt like the city is hopeless and I'm just going to leave. But then instead she moved back. She moved into her great aunt's old house. She settled in and she started creating this urban farming organization where they started planting gardens all over the city with clean soil so that they'd be safe. But they started planting all these gardens in public places, and it led to the sense of joy that you and I have been talking about, of like people coming together and feeling like something beautiful can grow here. And that over the years has created other conversations leading all the way up to now, where they're actually having a very active, very bold conversation about, is it possible for the community to say, this refinery needs to retire? We're done with oil. We don't need to have this here anymore.
I know the answer to that. Yes. I feel like the question is, how do we make that happen? Because there's going to be a lot of opposition. Because you talked about dependence, you talked about addiction. And the flip side to that is, or the opposite of that is, to me, freedom. And you're talking about biking. In your personal experience, for your whole life has been freedom, or your family's life has been freedom. You talked about your personal experience of, well, I guess the train, it brought fun and I think also freedom. Mm-hmm. And if this personal commitment that you did from last time to this time meant that the biking, which you were doing long distance, becomes more also closer distance, it feels like a lot of freedom. And she's creating freedom with the biking there.
Mm-hmm. They're also creating economic freedom because they're creating new businesses. Like new businesses have moved in, green businesses in the city, like some organic agriculture distributors, like organic food distributors, some solar companies, some other kinds of sustainable, like there's a company that uses aquaculture to grow different kinds of vegetables. There's all sorts of interesting little enterprises happening in the city that are local. And excuse me, that gives the city, us, the community, a level of economic freedom or an ability to start to step away from their dependence on Chevron.
Now, I don't want to sound too simplistic, but my gut tells me that people probably feel like we have to wean ourselves off of Chevron and ramp up the other things. But I bet that if magically Chevron disappeared and all the money disappeared, I bet they would solve things faster.
I think it's complicated for a bunch of reasons, and some of them are legal reasons. There are legal reasons why you have to do it in a staged way. I've talked to activists in Los Angeles as well, because, you know, there's a moratorium on oil drilling now in Los Angeles. There's many people don't know that there's actually oil wells all over, like active oil wells and also inactive oil wells all over Los Angeles. And the city made a move recently in the last year to shut down all of that over time. But there are legal reasons why that has to happen over a longer period of time than maybe people might want. So, you know, there's a lot of legal analysis and research and work that's gone into what's the time frame that has to happen. So, I mean, the same thing is true in Richmond. And there's also 500 refinery workers who will need other kinds of jobs who, you know, depend on Chevron for their livelihood. And so I think they want to do it in a way that is gradual enough that the community can make adjustments, and especially a community like Richmond, where there's a lot of people who are really stretched thin financially. But also they want to make sure that Chevron leaves in a way that there's a plan for how that site gets cleaned up, because it's super toxic. And they want the company to take financial responsibility for cleaning that up, because it's the company that's benefited from that place.
Somewhere there's a group of people saying, how can we get out of here? We're going to have to get out of here. How can we not clean anything up? Because that's really expensive.
Yeah. Well, it happens. It happens in other places. Companies create shell companies. They file for bankruptcy. They pick up and leave, and they leave the community and the public with a lot of the cost. So Richmond doesn't want that to happen there.
Did I talk to you before about Doe versus Unocal, which I think Unocal became Chevron, or Chevron bought Unocal?
You didn't.
There's a past guest, Katie Redford. She was a law student at the time and was in, I think it was then called Burma, and Myanmar. And she saw that, let's see if I can remember it all, a company called Unocal, an oil company, was building a pipeline to go through a pipeline there. And the government said, okay, you got to use our army to do it. And so they paid the army, and the army kicked people off their land. Now the people were displaced, so they enslaved them. There's rape and murder, and this is all documented. And she struggled to figure out if she could do anything about it as an American citizen. She was in law school then. When she returned to the States, as I recall, and check the episode with her to get the details, but she wrote a paper. She found this law on the books from like the 18th century. I think maybe Thomas Jefferson had a hand in it, that she was able to figure out how to use it for foreign nationals to sue an American company for doing things outside of the U.S., and her professor said, you get an A for it because excellent research, you've written it up really well. Too bad, it would never actually work in practice. And she was like, watch me. And so she started this company called Earth Rights, I think. And they either won the case or at least led Chevron or Unocal to settle for a huge amount, like hundreds of millions of dollars. And then they used that to do similar things with other Shell and other places in Africa. And it was, a big precedent-setting case. And she was just an amazing, inspirational person to talk to about one person taking on so much in the face of resistance.
I think it's a similar thing in Richmond. I mean, I think very few communities have been bold enough to say, we really want to think about how we have the power to make this refinery close down and on our terms. And just a lot of places aren't, because of the power of the oil industry, both economically and legally and in other ways. And, just because of the ways that feeds into a lot of local politics and a lot of national politics, of course, a lot of communities aren't ready to step up and say that kind of thing. But California, a lot of things are happening in California, and Richmond especially has a long, long legacy of progressive activism. They have a local political party and a local progressive movement that has elected a lot of people to the city council. So they have leadership there that's willing to say, we don't want to take campaign money from Chevron. That used to be more of a thing that a lot of candidates for local office would be. A lot of people who got elected to local office would be taking campaign money from Chevron. And then they've gone on to say, we don't want Chevron here. We want to have an upfront discussion about what it would look like if we could set the terms for how this kind of shutdown happens and what happens in the future and what happens to the land and what happens with cleanup.
So you've been there, you've spoken with the people, and over time, what's the feel, what's the emotional tenor of the people, the community? I mean, there must be a range. What's your read?
Yeah, there was a survey done. It was a somewhat informal survey of Richmonders. But when I say it was somewhat informal, it was also a really sizable number of people. So there was a group called the Richmond Listening Project that went around knocking door to door, and they went to churches and they went to community meetings and they asked people what they thought about the refinery. And one of the fascinating things about their results was that a large majority of the people they asked said the community would actually be better off if the refinery wasn't there anymore. And that seemed like a major revelation and probably a major shift as well. I don't think that Richmond has always felt that way. One big shift that happened in the community was about 10 years ago, or more than 10 years ago now, there was a major refinery accident and fire. So there was an explosion that later was shown to be part of company negligence. Chevron hasn't been doing as well as it should be with making sure that things are well maintained and safe inside the refinery. So there was an explosion in one of the units, and that caused a huge fire. You could see the flames above the rooftops. There was this massive plume of smoke that was higher than Mount Tam, which is across the bay in San Francisco, if you know San Francisco. And 15,000 people around the region showed up at health clinics and hospitals complaining of respiratory issues the days after that. So it was huge. And understandably, the community was angry. And I think it changed everyone's feelings about what this company was and what this facility was. I think people really understood that what they wanted and the future they wanted and the healthy, safe place that they wanted to live in, those desires were not compatible with having a big, aging, polluting refinery there.
People constantly call me extreme for doing things like not flying, but I feel like we're funding this stuff. I mean, if every time we fill up a tank of gas, every time we buy an airplane ticket, we're giving them money to keep going. I mean, they don't buy their own products.
Yeah.
And I know one of the things that's kind of in the background of what we're talking about is individual action, which I think systemic change begins with personal change. And I haven't felt a sense of loss in my life. On the contrary, it's improved my life vastly to not fly, to avoid packaged food and all these things. Was it when we were recording or not that I said how a friend of mine is running for office, and someone posted on the message board there for funding, and said, you know, they were calling for funding, and I said, everyone, consider how much you've spent on filling your gas tanks, buying plane tickets, and buying things that were shipped by container ship across the world and things like that. That's how much you've spent on the opposition. That's how much you spent on extraction and depletion, combustion, and things like that. Consider that when you're considering how much you want to fund this. Actually, the responses were positive on that one. I wasn't sure if I was pushing people too much, because a lot of people say, well, that's extreme. I have to drive. I can't help it. So, I mean, I guess all the listeners know that about me, at least the regular listeners, but I feel like we're not getting that enough, that how much we're funding the opposition.
I think it's true, and I think it's also true that Chevron and companies like it have used their political muscle and their money and their legal muscle to try to suppress efforts to create policies that would, say, expand electric vehicles, expand public transit, reduce the, you know, the actual act of extracting the oil. Companies like Chevron have been bad actors. One of the things that I talk about in my book, and that's pretty widely covered by people like Naomi Oreskes is at Harvard, is how companies like this have spread misinformation among the public for years. So a lot of the climate denial that exists in the country exists because these companies funded organizations that spread disinformation about climate change and said that it wasn't happening. So it is true that when you fuel up at the pump, you're sending money to one of these companies. And it's also true that these companies have made it more difficult to make other kinds of choices. So I think the campaigns that exist to try to confront the power of these industries are really important, because if we're going to have a collective conversation about how to move beyond oil, we need that kind of noise and interference to not be part of it.
The phrase that I looked this up. I don't know if I made it up or what, but I like to say top down, bottom up, everywhere, all at once, starting here and now with you and me.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
I said something similar because I think we're in, I mean, this is basically what I think you're saying, but we're in such an emergency right now that everything else, there isn't one solution to climate change. There's many.
That's one way that definitely that perspective applies. Another one is that what looks like deprivation sacrifice before you do it is actually not. It's a restoration of values like do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which, you know, that's one representation of this reciprocity of the golden rule that's in, as far as I know, every culture ever and that we've looked at. Then leave it better than you found it, live and let live. We don't really practice those anymore with regard to how we treat each other when mediated through the environment in this culture. It's like, if you want to do it, if you can afford it, go for it. We don't think about, I mean, I think our culture has really let go of how does it affect others. And we think, oh man, I don't want to think about everyone else when I turn on my air conditioner. I just want to have a more comfortable room.
Mm-hmm.
But in my experience, caring about others is the best part of being human. I mean, love thy neighbor, you know, as spoken in one tradition, but it's like also not just in that tradition, is not like, or else. It's actually a recipe for a great life.
Yeah.
Even if the humidity is a bit higher than it would have been if you had the air conditioner on.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other part of the equation and one that the book deals with is it, question of justice. So even a community like Richmond, I mean, when you look at communities that are lower income, that are struggling with more poverty, they generally have also lower fossil fuel footprints, you know, just because people may live closer together, they may live in multi-generational families, but they're also having to suffer a larger burden than a lot of the rest of us for the fossil fuel extraction that we all are, you know, relying on, or some of us are relying on more than others, but the Richmond has had for many decades to bear the burden of having this fossil fuel plant there. But Richmond also is probably contributing per capita a lot less to fossil fuel pollution than some other kinds of communities where people have a lot of money and they're flying everywhere. So, I mean, I think there's also questions of fairness that I especially think people who have, there's that, you know, that, actually, it may be a phrase from Spider-Man. Phrase like
with great responsibility. Yeah.
To whom much is given, much is expected. There's also a biblical phrase along those lines. But I mean, you know, when you have, I think with great power comes great responsibility is those, maybe the Spider-Man one. But the idea that you know, the more power and privilege you have, also the greater voice and power you have to try to make change, including making personal decisions about what you do, so that you know, you're not creating this burden for other people in the world.
Yeah, and also personal responsibility isn't bad.
Sure.
I mean, can you imagine a parent who's like, oh, I don't like responsibility? It's great. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you don't get to do everything you want, whenever you want, however you want it. But actually, that's not necessarily, that to me is not the same as freedom. That's like, it could border on chaos, but it's freedom exists within a structure, and we're human and we're social species, and caring about others and taking responsibility for how we affect them. I when I was a kid, I definitely said many times when whoever dies with the most toys wins. And that wasn't about thinking about others. That was about me, me, me. But maturity in adulthood has improved my life. And one of the big ways is not just me, me, me. Don't get me wrong. I can be pretty selfish and pretty vain, but less than before.
Yeah.
And it's joyful. It's joy. Joy. What's the word? What's the word that comes with responsibility when you take into account others and put the, I do know what the word is. The word, because I've been thinking about this a lot, because I'm climbing up and down the stairs all the time to bring the solar panels up to the roof. And I struggle to figure out why I'm doing it and how I could explain to others. And the word for when you put someone's interests, what matters to them, not what I want for them, but what matters to them, and I put that first, that's love.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I had a moment with the book where I had just finished a draft of it, and I was really exhausted, and in that way that makes you a little bit silly. And so late at night, I wrote this message to my book editor about what I thought it all meant, because I was trying to think of what else did I need to include to bring it all together. So I wrote this late night message in a state of exhausted silliness about how the book was all about love. And in the morning, I felt like it sounded like I was a little bit drunk, even though I was. but I think even though I was going on and on about love in a way that seemed a little bit overly sentimental to me later, it was also true. I think that when I wrote this book about communities and how people come together in a community to try to respond to different aspects of the climate crisis, I was really writing a book about love, about people who love their community, about people who love their place and who love the landscape and the ecosystem and the region and the, you know, the beauty or the complexity that's part of all of that. There's a few different, since we've been talking about Richmond, there's a few different scenes that come to mind from that story that exemplify that for me. One is the story of this farm that they put together, that they built on the outside of the city in North Richmond, which is an unincorporated area. It was a farm. It's called the North Richmond Farm. And it was on an old ranch site that the ground was actually like really devoid of much organic matter. It was, Dory describes it as being like crushed rock. And it was also full of all this illegally dumped material. Like people had put like old barbed wire and like couches and miscellaneous bits of junk and metal and, you know, scrap all over the site. And so to convert it into a farm was like this incredible act of like almost like excavation. They had to go through it like foot by foot in these big crews and like just dig it out and pull the stuff out and take it away and then bring tons and tons of compost to the site. They even brought goats to the site at some point to have them like munch down all the weeds. And just, they brought crews of women who are from this program that works with women who've been incarcerated and recently released from prison and are trying to learn new job skills. And so they hired those folks to come and work. And then there's just this tremendous volunteer effort of local people and people who are on staff of this urban farming organization, kids and teachers and all kinds of people came out and they just went through the dirt and they cleaned things up and they brought out compost. And eventually, after a few years, they were able to start putting down crop rows. And now it's this beautiful farm that you wouldn't imagine what it had looked like before. They have an orchard and they have kale and they have a chicken coop and they have beautiful flowers growing everywhere and tomatoes, and they feed thousands of people every week through the CSA. And I think it's a story of love. Like, I think it's, you know, you wouldn't go through all of that effort just for pure economic gain. It was a huge amount of work to create this thing, but it was about saying we love this place and we want to tend it and we want to reimagine what it can be, and we're going to come together as a community and build something beautiful here. And it's a gorgeous place, and there was a lot of joy in doing that. And again, I think it helped people see that Richmond could be something else. Richmond could be something beautiful and healthy. It doesn't just have to be an oil refinery town.
You're making me hungry. You're making me want to be there. You're making me want to talk to the people, because there's a Drew Gardens up in the Bronx here. They, on a smaller scale, they took this wrecked place on the Bronx River, the only freshwater river in New York City, and they turned it into the most wonderful space. I mean, it's up there with Central Park, in my opinion, in some ways surpassing it because of that community aspect. It's not so corporate. And then when you mentioned the kale, I'm like, oh, I want to get some, because home cooked, here's a phrase I say a lot, home cooked tastes better even when it tastes worse, and homegrown tastes better even when it tastes worse. But that stuff from Drew Gardens tastes better. And I would not expect butternut squashes from the Bronx to be the sweetest I've tasted, and yet they are.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask more about that, but also, if the timing goes right, today, the listeners listening, is the day your paperback comes out. And I'm really interested to hear if you've heard back from listeners, not listeners, readers, and how it's evolved your sense of the book. What's happened since it's gone out there? You put it out in the world.
Yeah, I think I talked a little bit about this last time, but I've done a lot of events with the book, and they've evolved from being just your traditional book event where you show up at a bookstore and read from the book and talk about it to being much more community-based. So I've done a number of events. Probably the most significant one was on Bainbridge Island, which is across the water, across the Puget Sound from Seattle. And on Bainbridge Island, we got together and I talked about the stories that are part of the book. And I also talked about how those stories might connect with people's experiences here in the Puget Sound, and especially on Bainbridge Island. And I talked about some of the people in the book and, you know, told their stories so that people could see that they're real people just like them who, you know, could do things about the climate impacts that we're all facing. And then there was a presentation from Laura Hansen, who's a scientist, a climate scientist with the IPCC. And she also runs an organization called EcoAdapt. And she talked about what's happening locally. And then everybody got together in groups and they talked about what can they do there on Bainbridge Island? What can we create? What do we value? What do we love about this community? And what do we want to protect? What's happening? What kinds of risks are we facing now? And it was really beautiful. And I think it was just how I want the book to be used. So that was incredibly heartening. I've also heard people say things like, the book made me feel less alone, which seems very profound to me, because I think feeling alone is very disempowering and one of the things that keeps us from taking action. I've heard people say that they found the book comforting in some way because it made them, again, it made them feel like they weren't alone. There are other people in the world who are working on trying to confront this crisis, and there are things we can all do. So those are all things that I really wanted, and I'm very happy to hear that people are finding them in the book.
You have to echo that. One of the words that comes up with me a lot is isolation, and I feel like our culture is moving that way. And so something that makes people feel connected and the opposite of isolation, to me, is what we need, one of the many things we need.
Yeah. I guess I can mention really quickly something else that we also said we might get to in this conversation, which is I have a discussion in the book about Eleanor Ostrom.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The Director of the Commons and Garrett Hardin, which is also a story about collective, yes, being commonality versus individualism. So Garrett Hardin wrote the famous paper, The Tragedy of the Commons, in 1968. And it's come to dominate a lot of people's thinking about how environmental issues work. And people cite it. I was just at a conference where a student brought it up in the middle of a discussion. And no one really even questioned it as a dilemma. And yet, Eleanor Ostrom basically showed that for the most part, wasn't really a real thing. The tragedy of the commons is this idea that like we have this common resource, like the atmosphere or like the oceans, or in Hardin's example, it was a pasture. And if we all share this resource, like a pasture, we're all so selfish, then inevitably we're just gonna overgraze it and it'll be sad and terrible. And we're all just destined to ruin the thing that we're sharing. He even had a quote that was, "Ruination is the destination toward which all men rush." And his belief was that what we needed to solve this problem was to privatize things or to have very top-down governance, like kind of almost like a dictatorship to tell everyone what to do because we couldn't be trusted to our own devices. And it was based on zero empirical evidence. It was just based on some, honestly, on some 19th century writing by another thinker who hadn't really even verified what he was claiming about pastures in England. Eleanor Ostrom went out around the same time through her work and studied how different groups of people around the world are actually managing common resources. And she started in Los Angeles with how groundwater is being managed. And then she branched out to study also grazing and irrigation and lots of other kinds of examples about how communities manage common resources. And she found that there are lots of places where people have for many generations in a sustainable way managed to share something. And the way that it works is that there's, you know, usually multiple agencies involved, there's multiple actors, there's, you know, ways for people to know what everybody else is doing and sort of to set limits on things. And really the systems that she studied that were successful in managing things looked a lot like democracy. They looked like true democracy where everyone has a voice and solutions are decided collectively and there's systems in place for how those work. And those systems are based on, you know, what people need locally. And her findings are really profound. And I think not enough people in the environmental movement knew about her work. But I think it, again, it points to this idea that the solutions we need have to do with collective decision-making and to do with people having a voice and people having power over what our future is going to look like. And actually people sharing things, sharing resources.
Yeah, I confess that I was one of these people who I heard about tragedy of the commons and I said, well, the solution is privatization or top-down police. And otherwise we're kind of stuck and then nothing we can do about it. And I think I read both your book and I don't know if you've read Jason Hickel's Less is More, but he also looks at the tragedy of the commons and how much communities have seen these things all over the place. Yeah, it's like shepherds and fishers and all sorts of places where there was a commons and people got together and they worked it out and the communities became stronger, not weaker, and more sustainable, not less. And I think he ended up, what's his name, who wrote that paper, retracting, but saying like, oh, unmanaged commons have a tragedy, but managed ones don't. And I think he, yeah, it's like something like one of the most cited papers and people don't, up until your book and one other book, I kind of heard of her name. I think she won a Nobel Prize. But
you did, yeah.
Yeah, so like should know more, but I should have known more. But yeah, that really got me rethinking. I just felt like we're stuck. Nothing we can do.
I think a lot of people have this misperception, and I think it really guides our culture. And that's probably part of why Hardin's work was picked up so much, was that it fits into a lot of our problematic cultural sensibilities about individualism and about, you know, how we have to privatize. I mean, isn't that really a lot of the fundamental assumptions of capitalism that we each need to have our own, you know, individual things? But empirically, Eleanor Ostrom showed that not only can there be systems where there's collective management of things, but also, you know, privatization often makes a mess out of things. I mean, we can see that in a lot of cases. I'll also just add, as sort of a side note, but not entirely a side note, I mean, Garrett Hardin was a a white supremacist. He had very troubling views, and he was on some watch lists for his views about white supremacy and his Islamophobia. And I don't think those are entirely disconnected. I mean, I think he had this very troubling sort of exclusionist view of how the environment should be managed. And there's a lot of reasons why we should dismantle those ideas and pick them apart.
I've come across that about him as well. And he wasn't just an individual there, but he was part of a community that was had agendas, beliefs that he was furthering.
Mm-hmm.
And so listeners, go check it out if that's interesting to you, especially if I hadn't known your book and Hickel's book, then I would, like talking to me then, you really want to learn this stuff, Josh, of a year ago and all his life before that.
So I'm also thinking of this other image from Richmond that I think connects to what we've been talking about. So there's another garden as well that predates the North Richmond farm I was talking about. It was actually the first farm that Doria worked on, and it was on a bicycle path. So it brings together everything we were talking about. It was on this bicycle path called the Richmond Greenway. She and some of her other community members decided to, they brought in clean soil and they set up these raised beds and they built this beautiful berry patch where they grew all kinds of raspberries and huckleberries and blueberries and, you know, hardy kiwis and all kinds of things. And then they also started growing vegetables. And as they started doing this, other people in the community started coming out and saying, "What are you doing?" And in a good way, like, "What are you doing? And can I help?" And this is, keep in mind, in a community that at the time, and even to some degree now, there was a lot of crime and people were very distrustful. And so people were, you know, a little bit edgy about coming out and talking to their neighbors. And so people started coming out and gathering in this collective place, and they started working the gardens, and they started having regular like picnics at the site where people would come and cook and they would serve food. And then the Greenway over time, through not just the work of Doria's organization, but lots of others, evolved into this place where there's lots of public gathering spaces. There's public parks. There's an area where kids can ride bikes over all these little, this little course of like hills and jumps and things. There's, you know, different kinds of gathering places. There's an orchard, and there's all of these beautiful spaces along this bike path that was formerly a rail path. And again, it's created this completely different sense of what the city is. It's made the city safer because having more people out on the street and public places, getting together, talking to each other, knowing each other, actually makes the community vastly safer than if everybody's hunkering down in their house. And then simultaneously, it's given people this sense that, again, that you can create something beautiful in Richmond. And those kinds of places are where people have the conversations that often become kind of revolutionary. Like, now that we're all here and talking about gardening and eating food, you know, what could the politics look like here? And like, how could we get more people on the city council who want to see a different future for the city? And then how can we shut down this refinery? Can we do that? So like those conversations, all they often arise, that kind of creativity arises out of people coming together. And it, you know, it can all start with these very simple things of making something beautiful.
Now, you're talking about your book, At Home on an Unruly Planet. It's coming out in paperback today. And now we've talked about Richmond. I wonder if we, to wrap it up, could you share the other, I mean, there's fire and flood. Can you share the other communities that you talked about in the book?
Yeah. Yeah, and we talked about this before somewhat too, but there's four communities. So there's Okanagan County, Washington, and the Mattow Valley, which is a community that's gone through a series of mega wildfires and had to recover from those. And that story is both about a community coming together and learning how to rebuild, but it's also a lot about how do we take care of our forests and how do we take care of our ecosystems so that we are less at risk of fire and so that we protect nature. And there's a lot of wisdom from ecologists and also from indigenous communities about how we do that. A second story is set in St. Augustine, Florida. And there, the community, like so much of Florida, has been facing a lot of both stronger hurricanes and sea level rise. And it's also one of the most historic communities in the country. So the city dates back to this when the Spanish settled there in the 1500s. And there's layers and layers of incredible history there. The civil rights movement had a bunch of key victories there. There's all this incredible architecture and the Spanish Revival architecture throughout the city. There's lots of fascinating things that have happened in that place. And so there's a community of people there who are working to try to protect this history and these stories against this flooding. And it's a lot about how do we like protect a city from the rising water. And then the third community is Newtok, Alaska, which is an Alaska Native community that's having to relocate because of major erosion at the old village where they had been living for many decades, in a region where they've lived, you know, they have heritage back for thousands of years. And because of the thawing of permafrost, the ice that binds the soil together, and because of the thawing of the ice that used to be around in the winter, the land is just getting hit a lot with more waves and more storms and more erosion. And the land is just really falling apart. It's pretty disturbing. But the hopeful part of the story is that they're moving. About half the community has moved now over to this other, much more stable piece of land across the water. And they're building this whole community that they're reimagining, like with wind power and really sustainable water treatment and ways to continue a lot of their traditional cultural subsistence practices. And so that's also, to me, an especially beautiful story about reimagining things. So they're all about communities coming together. And then the book is, I wove through all these reflections about home and about, you know, why taking action at home matters. And including these ideas about Eleanor Ostrom and Garrett Hardin. And so those help, I think, to stand back and reflect on what these stories mean and where we are in this moment right now.
Thank you for giving that overview. And is there anything I didn't think to ask before wrapping up? Or anything you want to leave the listeners with?
Well, you can go to my website, which is madelinebooksrander.com. And there's more about the book. I am starting a fellowship at MIT. There's a program called the Knight Science Journalism Program, Knight, KNIGHD. And I'll be there doing a project, doing some work on developing new climate journalism, new stories. And I'm hoping to start a newsletter as I'm out there for the year. So on my website, people can look for that too.
Well, Madeline Ostrander, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a really fun conversation. A joyful one, I should say.
Me too. Thank you. How many people are bringing a message of joy from what everyone calls saving the environment, but I call the future? Step by step, this podcast is creating a culture of joy, community, and connection around sharing and acting on our environmental values. Again, there's no profit in buying and wasting less, but we'll all love our lives and relationships more when we do. I can use your support. Please donate at joshuasporek.com/donate. Again, that's joshuasporek.com/donate.